It can't be like this.
It is this way, man. I'm sorry I exposed you to it, but it is. It's ugly. But it's necessary.
I became a cop to put away drug dealers, the poisoners, the criminals, not to be one.
You sound just like me. And I know what you're going through. I know what you're feeling. You're scared.
I'm not scared.
Yes, you are. You're terrified. Everybody goes through that the first time. I went through it.
The sooner you can match what's in your head with what's going on in the real world, the better you're gonna feel. In this business, you gotta have a little dirt on you for anybody to trust you. And when all this is behind you, there's gonna be a whole other world that opens up for you. I walk a higher path, son. I can give you the keys to all the doors.
What are you talking about?
My guys are pretty good, but they're not leaders, they're clowns. You're a leader. You want my job, you got it. You want to lock up poisoners, this is the best place to do it. But you gotta just, you know, take your time. You make detective, you play the game, you grow wise, and then you can change things. But you gotta change them from the inside, son. Let's go downtown to the station. You talk to my guy, Stan. And they'll walk you through what you gotta say to the DA guys, okay?
I'm Madeline, and I'm a writer and cultural critic.
I'm Dave, I'm a comedian and actor. Welcome to Genre Reveal Party, where we talk about TV and movies through the lens of genre, its definition, its limits, and what we can learn by exploding them. This is a bonus episode of season two. We don't need another hero. We are wrapped, but that was our season about heroes and villains, and the movie we are talking about today, Training Day, is in my mind a particularly potent text about heroes and villains, and I really wanted to have the guest we have on an episode, and so this is what we've got, a bonus episode on Training Day with Dylan Rodriguez. Hello, Dylan.
What's up? Yeah, I'm honored to be part of a bonus episode, and I can't wait to think about this terror of a movie with you.
Sure, absolutely.
In full disclosure, I have not theorized or preconceptualized what the genre reveal will be on my end.
That's great.
And by the way, fuck you for making me watch this movie again. All right, there.
Oh, okay. It wouldn't be a podcast. It wouldn't be a podcast of mine where Dylan guests if he didn't say fuck you to me, which it happened last time. You thought I called you old, if you remember that, Dylan.
I turned 50. Since the last time we talked, I turned 50. So now I can't even cuss you out anymore if you decide you want to call me old.
That's the line? That's where old is?
Look, to me it is. To me it is. I'm still in denial, even though I just admitted it on the air.
50's the new 30, man. 50's young.
Yeah. Say that to my lower back. All right, then.
Yeah. Well, okay. So Training Day. We're talking about Training Day. I will, once we get into the chat, I'll talk about kind of like what my thoughts were about why I thought of you, Dylan, specifically. Oh, Dylan, but you know, credits one of the co-founders of Critical Resistance, you know, excellent, brilliant abolitionist scholar and writer. And I don't know. How do you prefer to be introduced?
That's great. I appreciate that. I have a day job at University of California, the Riverside campus. The one thing I'm very proud of is I'm one of the, I guess, kind of inaugural faculty members of the new Department of Black Study.
Oh, wow.
Hell yeah.
I'm a faculty member there. I'm a faculty member in something called the Department of Media and Cultural Studies. And I co-direct our humanities center called the Center for Ideas and Society, specifically, I curate a stream of programming and different forms of events and conversations, experimental stuff called Decolonizing Humanism. So I'm really happy to be doing that. And the stuff that y'all are doing today is informing how I think about that stuff too. So yeah, this approach to genre, this approach to kind of oppositional readings of Hollywood productions of police symbols, police mm-hmm. narratives, mm-hmm. Thinking about Denzel Washington's body of work and mm-hmm. what the Academy Awards actually are. I mean, all that shit mm-hmm. is right here, mm-hmm. right totally. In front of us.
Totally.
And well, like Denzel, you're a sports dad.
That's right. That's you right. That you have your own little John David Washington.
Oh, man. Yes. I will guiltily accept that. I have no choice.
Well, let me do a quick sort of like hit the plot points of Training Day here. You know, it's not a buddy cop movie, sort of an anti buddy cop movie mm-hmm. in some ways. Ethan Hawke, ex-military, new dad, is joining the narcotics unit of the LAPD. It's his first day. Denzel is his, I don't know what the position is, captain. He's his head guy. He's training him. And he is constantly testing him. He makes him smoke weed that he claims is laced with PCP, which he then uses against him when he sort of not frames him because he's working with him, but later on they kill an ex-cop who became a drug dealer and use Ethan Hawke as the sort of like fresh blood to claim it's a righteous killing, you know, firing in the line of duty. And when Ethan Hawke starts to buck at some of these things, he's like, they're going to test your blood. There's PCP in your blood. Mm-hmm. So it's all over the course of one day. At a certain and it's clear by the time they get into, I think Roger is the name of that drug dealer's house, that Denzel has orchestrated this day. Denzel's character's name is Alonzo. Ethan Hawke is Jake Hoyt. I'll use those names interchangeably.
Sure.
And I think, yeah, so Alonzo has orchestrated this day to exploit Jake Hoyt's status as a rookie on narcotics, kind of a rookie police officer. I think he's still like a year and a half on the force. There is various lionizing of the LAPD, which is interesting. This movie came out in 2001. Mm-hmm. It came out in October 2001, which I wanted to see when in 2001 it came out. So technically a post 9/11 movie, but you know, it was obviously all made before that. It is still very much in the wake of the sort of original LA riots in the 90s and the Rodney King beating. And yeah, there's a lot to talk about. I think the other thing is that Denzel's character snapped in Vegas, we're told, and beat some generalized Russian to death because he just went overboard. And it turns out this was a connected Russian. So the Russians need $1 million from Denzel to not, you know, or they're going to kill him by, you know, they need it by midnight or whatever it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so all of these things that Alonzo's orchestrating are to get that money to pay off the Russians. End of the movie, there's a big face-off between Ethan Hawke and Denzel, where Ethan Hawke goes to the neighborhood that Denzel told him not to go to by himself and confronts him, takes him out of his mistress's house, played by Eva Mendez, who he has a kid with. And Denzel thinks the neighborhood people are all gathered around. Denzel thinks they're going to support him. They're all kind of like, you got to do your own work. We support Jake in a way. Jake walks away, leaves them to deal with him. He gets out, but then the very end of the movie is him being Denzel, pulling up to an intersection. A bunch of black cars with guys with machine guns get out. Clearly the Russians have found him. They gun him down. Ethan Hawke walks back into his home with the sounds of the news report of Alonzo's death. And that's all I want to do in terms of plot summary. So yeah, sure. Let's chat.
I think because of this movie, Ethan Hawke never got fucking braces.
Wait, what?
I'm just making that shit up. just saying, like, I'm just distracted by the fact that this dude's in Hollywood and he's on high def and all that stuff, and he wins an Academy Award, which I'm convinced that's why the dude never bothered to go get his teeth fixed.
I did not notice how fucked up his teeth were.
Hey, look, my teeth are crooked as fuck, so I'm not even trying to judge. I'm just saying, like, I think that there's something about that.
But he didn't
snarl tooth. Yeah.
Something like that.
Ethan Hawke didn't win for this. He was just nominated for supporting.
He was nominated.
Right.
Washington won.
But should he have been? But should he have been? That's the point, right?
Like, let's get into
there's
this.
Some overachievement. There's some overachievement happening here.
You think some white deceptionism is happening?
This was by far not Denzel Washington's best performance either. You feel me? So there's a lot going on.
I mean, I wanted to talk to you, Dylan, because I thought of you because when you came on my other podcast, This Is Your Afterlife, not my main or real podcast. I just want to say that. I've made that mistake in the past. But we talked about Copaganda, and it was a really nuanced conversation that I appreciated. And so, this movie as an entry, a prime celebrated entry in the Copaganda canon. Mm-hmm. And I was curious, it's an LA, it's a California movie. You, as a California guy, I was curious if there was any, what relationship you had to that element of it. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I mean, why fuck me for making you watch this? let's start there. Yeah. It seems like you hate this movie.
No. Okay. So I have a strange relationship to films like this. So I'm going to say Training Day is nothing special when I talk about it in this context. Okay. So there's a bunch of films like this that I have a strange relationship with where the film's narrative is cliche. It's highly predictable. Mm-hmm. Of course you have top quality performers and artists in there, but the actual script is not, there's nothing about it that is really surprising or interesting. There's really no twists involved. I mean, everything's, the Russians are a cliche.
Yes.
You left out, right? The defining scene that shows us Jake's heroism is where he saves the cousin from being raped. Like a back alley sexual assault.
Yeah.
Well, he didn't save her from it. She was sexually assaulted, but he intervenes on the sexual assault that could have actually gotten even more brutal and violent. So that's entirely predictable that you got the white cop standing in there and Alonzo Denzel's in the background watching, spinning his chrome plated, nine and all this stuff. So a strange relationship with these films because when they come on the TV, because every now and then I'll flip through, I can't help but tune in and watch it.
Sure. Is it like Law and Order or something like that?
So I have a weird relationship with these criminogenic narratives. Mm-hmm. So podcasts like the long form criminogenic so-called real crime, true crime, whatever. Right, I try not to use that title because it's bullshit.
Yeah.
I get caught up listening to those. I think I'm fascinated with the sense of self-assuredness that criminology and criminal forensic specialists have about their alleged science. And yet the entire premise of so many of these long form podcasts is how fabricated and made up and flawed they always are. And then on the other hand, there's something analogous about these high profile, highly funded Hollywood scripts that get greenlit and turned into this kind of like a really rough, sloppy analog of what was basically a contemporaneous scandal in LAPD with the Rampart scandal. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're basically overlapping at this point,
And what's the Rampart scandal? I don't know it.
Okay, so the Rampart scandal, folks should look this up. They should Wikipedia this shit, but it's like the latter 1990s into the early 2000s. One of the largest police, and I'm going to use the term scandal here with a sense of sarcasm and facetiousness, mm-hmm. because when they call it a scandal, it implies that this is not, that these are not police activities that happen regularly. Okay. Mm-hmm. So what essentially happens in the latter 1990s into the early 2000s is you have the formation within the Rampart division of the LAPD of what is essentially a police gang, by which I mean in a kind of extra legal faction of the police department that regularly engaged in so-called criminal activity, extra legal activity. The difference being that they are not simply a gang. They're a police gang, which means they carry a badge and they have a license to kill, and they have a legally fortified, historically compounded sense of impunity. So part of what they did, aside from intimidating people, stealing things, running their own extra legal economy, is that they were involved in hurting and killing people all the time, you know, intimidating and occupying entire neighborhoods in ways that extended way beyond conventional police occupation intimidation. They were involved with Suge Knight in some strange ways. So this went on and on. I think we'll never know exactly how many people ended up being incarcerated and jailed or even just put on charges because of the actions of the people in the Rampart scandal. But it was a widely broadcast kind of implosion in the LAPD. And it was how it is that this thing called the crash unit came to be a kind of common parlance for at least a little while, right? Crash being this so-called anti-gang unit stood for Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums. Who the fuck says hoodlums? Who says hoodlums?
That's cop acronym.
Oh my God. They're like looking for a way to have a cool acronym or whatever. So yeah, the crash, so-called crash anti-gang unit. So you had, I think, almost 100 cops that were actually charged with all these different forms of misconduct. But it was rampant. The thing is, it was rampant police violence against ordinary people. Mm-hmm. It was rampant police shit. That's some of the shit you saw depicted in Training Day, right? Like a kind of a regular, normalized practice of putting false, planting false evidence on people so that they'd get brought up on like major, major serious felony charges. They were involved in dealing, you know, street drugs. You know, obviously covering shit up. They lied regularly in the context of criminal justice trials. Again, I say all this, you know, under the rubric of the Rampart scandal, with the understanding, I hope, that everybody listening here will accept the fact that these are only scandals because they were revealed. Right. They were scandals because of the scale. They're scandals because they essentially got kind of fictionalized by way of Training Day and mm-hmm. Fuqua's approach to this, right? And Denzel's, you know, kind of shadow depiction of probably the central police character in the Rampart scandal, this guy Rafael Perez, right? Which I think Fuqua talked about that. I think either he or somebody else talked about how there's a kind of rough, Rafael Perez served as a kind of rough basis for the Alonzo character. So yeah, this is all happening at the same time, right? And so the Rampart scandal kind of reaches its, you know, criminal kind of juridical climax point in 1990, around 1998, 1999, something like that. And when Rafael Perez was finally arrested and they put him on trial and all this kind of stuff. So yeah, that stuff to this day, and you know, I'm not from California, but I've lived in California for most of my life now.
Right,
this Rampart scandal thing, even though the rest of probably most of the world outside Southern California has probably forgotten about it. I'm talking about like among teenagers here. Mm-hmm. I'm talking teenagers in Riverside County, not even LA County, Orange County, teenagers in Riverside County. They all know almost everybody still understands Rampart's scandal. Mm-hmm. LAPD and Rampart's at just a basic reference point, at least as powerful reference point as the 92 uprisings.
Well, that's what's funny about, like, one of the most ironic moments in the whole movie, almost an encapsulation, is at the very end when it's in that face-off with Ethan Hawke and Denzel, and Hoyt rips the badge off of Alonzo's neck and is like, "You don't deserve this badge." And I'm like, if anything, he deserves the badge more than anyone. This is the most representative of the LAPD guy I've ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd love for anybody to point at one actual incident in which anything close to resembling that took, you know, actually, if anything, that is the badge. The whole point is that is the badge, right?
Right.
I mean, but this performative white heroism is what made me cuss you out, right? Because like it's just so much. It's just so much that Ethan Hawke, the Jake character, it's just so much. Like, I still am in disbelief that he got that he was nominated for an Academy. Well, again, I shouldn't be in disbelief now that I've learned what the Academy is, right? But sure. I'm like, this dude got recognition for like whatever potential, you know, he got nominated for best for that, for being like the most cornball, you know, cliche white junior cop. You know, he's got his wife at home waiting for him earnestly, and he believes in his job, and he's here with Alonzo, who's got his skull cap on, who's like giving him PCP. And I mean, the stuff is it's corny. And yet, there's something fucked up that I have to be transparent about. I can't stop watching it when it's on. I can't stop watching it.
What's your relationship to Training Day, Madeline?
I had never seen it.
Oh, shit.
And I don't quite know why I avoided this movie, but I had a sense that I wasn't going to like it. And I also just, I knew everything about it, right? I didn't feel like it was necessary. I knew what was going to happen. I knew there was going to be like the Bonnie and Clyde, Sonny Corleone, like moment for Alonzo in the end. I just knew everything about it. So I didn't feel like it was necessary.
Is this one of those episodes where I'm going to be alone being like, oh, that's pretty fun. I like this movie. And everyone else is, did you end up hating it?
Well, I think it's politically just fucked, but but I was kind of, I mean, the thing I was interested in was the thing about, I think Ethan Hawke got nominated for the Oscar completely out of pity, but I think there is a kind of feat in his acting where he's holding his own in some way with this, I like Denzel Washington in some movies. I think he's incredible in all movies, but he does chew up scenery and he is a pretty selfish actor. He doesn't want anyone to look at anyone else in any scenes. Right. And I think like there's kind of, I was listening to an interview with Ethan Hawke about like how he prepared for the role and he,
is this the Marc Maron?
Yeah.
Episode?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He thought about it. Like as an athlete, right? Like he was thinking about Washington's game and how to meet him in this kind of athletic way, like as a boxer or something like that, that like he couldn't try to act or please Washington. He had to do things to almost like counterbalance Washington's performance. And I did find that, I don't know. It was kind of magnetic or something like that. I kind of agree. I think there's something different from it than like a throwaway Law and Order bullshit or something like that. There is something very interesting going on between these characters, but I don't think the movie really knows what that is. And then I was really troubled by the arc of the Hawk character, like. Why does he decide to like go through the projects at the end holding a gun
yeah,
out?
Yeah.
Then he gets beaten up like horribly and is left on a roof. And then it's almost like he's like Jason or Michael Myers, where he just like falls down on Denzel Washington's hood. I don't know. I just found that to be I'm glad I saw it because I actually wasn't expecting it to be that outrageous, you know. I thought it was just kind of going to be like, okay, this is like some pretty good acting. It could be like a two-man play or something like that with, you know, I do think they're both solid actors. I don't think it's the best performance out of either of them by a long shot, but yeah, I don't know.
I was made just a kind note of like, that it was like a slasher where the hero refuses to die. So I totally had that same Michael Myers reference in my mind as well.
And then he does get recuperated as a hero, which I guess I found a little bit surprising too. I thought it was going to be a little bit more like whatever gritty, where he realizes that he has to be a bad guy too, you know, in order to survive or something like that. But I don't think so at all. I think he's completely glorified in the ending. And I don't know if either of you thought that, but it was a little more cut and dry than I was expecting. I thought it was going to be more of a kind of anti-hero villain narrative for.
Yeah, I remembered, you know, thinking about heroes and villains too, I was like, oh, there's a way in which Denzel becomes a villain, but for a lot of the movie, he's an anti-hero. Mm-hmm. Not at all. From the beginning, this guy is there's one moment, there's a speech in the middle where Denzel is going, you have to change the system from the inside. Like, I was just like you, right. You know?
Yeah.
That's the sort of too little, too late attempt to, I mean, we've talked, Dylan and I, in other conversations about the problem of saying humanizing a cop, but that is the attempt to humanize him. And I was also surprised how, straight laced Ethan Hawke's character. I mean, they like show him in his fucking military uniform, the baby literally suckling at his wife's teat.
I know. Well, can we go back to that scene? That was one of the more interesting scenes to me. And I was interested.
To change it from the inside speech?
Yeah. Yeah. My impression of that scene was that it was winking at us like, this is bullshit, right? But maybe I'm being too generous. I don't know.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing about like reading, about like responding and reading to films like this is that who gives a fuck what the intent was?
Sure. Yeah.
So let's just like chuck that shit out the window. Like, we're on the way already in this conversation to reading this film as satire. I'm just going to point that out.
Is that a satirical moment, though, is I guess my question. I mean, that could have come out ahead of the makers for sure. Like, it was completely unintentional.
I mean, that's the thing, right? That to me, that makes it at a certain level that compounds the satirical nature of it is I actually think it was earnest.
Okay.
You know, there's nothing in the track record here to imply that that the writers, director, et cetera, were thinking deeply in that particular way.
Absolutely.
That little speech. And that's not the only moment. Okay. That's not the only moment in which I think we can read and respond to this film as comedy and as comedy of satirical.
Sure.
Of a satirical, of like ultra violent satire and not like the Tarantino version of it.
No.
Right.
Right. Like there's something more, I think, insidious and violent about this particular kind of satire, precisely because it's such a version of propaganda that is through the kind of old juxtaposition of the flawed, wayward, in this case, black cop, and the earnest, young, ex-high school, all-conference football players. I think he played strong safety. Of course he did, right? Well, what white boy that wasn't good at football didn't play strong safety?
Is that the
like that's come on. That's he's gonna play strong safety or middle linebacker or some shit,
okay,
right?
So
it's like cliche on top of cliche on top of cliche. Mm-hmm. You know? Ethan Hawke just has this face that you kind of want to punch him. Like not in a bullying way, it's like a snap out of it way. Right? Mm-hmm. He has kind of this kind of vacuous look in his eye all the time. Including that Netflix thing that just came out. Right,
like
the same look. He's got the same look in his eye in every film. I think that's his kind of calling card. Hey, I'm not hating. He made a career out of that shit, right? But, but it's to say there's some kind of at the level of reading it. I think maybe you know what? Maybe that's what draws me into keeping this shit on the TV, right? Okay. I mean that, and then waiting for Snoop to come on.
Who's the fucking great
the best
cameos.
Performance in the film is Snoop.
I thought Macy
at the
Macy
level, like,
Gray, Dr. Dre. I forgot Macy Gray was in this.
Macy Gray was in it. Yeah, like
she's really
shot,
good.
Like I was really, because I think this might have been the first time I saw Snoop on the big screen like that, and I was really in admiration of how well he pulled off this small role of his. Right, Dre was a little bit whatever. Right,
he
was
just kind of.
So, but Snoop was really good, and then.
And this is before Snoop becomes. Like, I mean, he had a cartoonishness from the beginning with his persona, but before he became a parody of himself where he can make endless commercials and clip shows.
Which is self-conscious, by the way.
Oh, like, for sure.
That's the difference. That's the difference, right? Is that Snoop does all that shit. Like he's doing that. He's doing that with absolute self-awareness.
Mm-hmm. Oh, totally. In Although at a certain point, it's like, yeah, very entrepreneurial. Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So it is interesting.
I like the question about satire, though, because I think part of it is that throughout, you're positioned as Jake uneasily. We don't want to be Jake, but we are positioned in this movie as mm-hmm. Jake. Mm-hmm. And then we're slowly or not so slowly, I mean, depending on how stupid you are, realizing that you're being conned by Alonzo, right?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think the feeling that you're being conned is part of the slippage of genre, right? Like, is this satire, or is it the feeling of being winked at is partly just yeah. like being kind of held hostage by this con artist, right? Like, yeah. And what and I found that's maybe the only really like politically vital aspect of this movie is that ambiguity, I guess.
Is it a satire or not?
Yeah.
Is that what you're saying?
Is it a satire yeah. or not? I mean, I guess that's the genre question, or, you know, how much are we being conned, or what are we being conned into thinking, right?
Well, that's a deep question. I appreciate it. You're actually helping me reframe how I'm going to talk about this. Both of you. So thank you for that. I'm going to have to cite you from now on because
you're welcome.
Thank you very much. No, what this is making me want to say out loud is that what the film points us toward is how police power itself is a deeply violent, satirical form of power. Mm. It, in other words, it's constantly telling on itself in these absurd ways that then become so persistent and so that's why when we started our conversation, right, I was saying we want to call it the Rampart Scandal. It's not scandal in the sense it's unusual,
mm-hmm. right?
Right. It's like it's persistent, it's constant, but like that's the nature of police powers, that it's like it's its own. It satirizes itself through its own violent absurdities all the fucking time, you know. And the other layer I'll throw on top of what the two of you are saying right now is how. The film is trying to construct kind of a charismatic, kind of a charismatic representation, like a sick evil charisma around police violence. I mean, that's Denzel, not Alonzo, right? He's like constructing this kind of evil charisma, this perverse mm-hmm. violent charisma around the shit he does, both in terms of the violence he actually carries out. You know, arguably the most serious of which we never see because it was in Vegas, right? It's a story about mm-hmm. Vegas, some shit he did to a Russian. But also in terms of what he, kind of passively consents to happening around him or orchestrates, right? The way he sets up, the way he sets up Jake to get, you know, his brains blown out in a bathtub by the so-called Latinx, Chicanx gang. A Smiley, the lead character was Smiley, is actually Maori, but
oh wow, we'll, yeah, we'll I was put that wondering.
Part aside. Yeah, we'll yeah, put yeah. that part aside.
We'll put it. Aside. Hmm. I yeah. wonder. Okay, so there's rumors which Washington has not confirmed, but other people on the cast have added to that the NAACP came to set and pressured him to either modify the role or back out of the role.
I remember hearing about that at the time as well.
And that was the part that I was trying to, because it's not that I like missed out on this cultural moment or anything like that, but I did ignore the movie when it came out. But there was a lot of pressure that he was facing to, this was his first villain that he'd ever played, right? And the politics of playing a bad black cop specifically. So I was wondering if you could speak to that. I mean, I understand it to be like at least the story of this movie as being somewhat unique to this film. At this point, maybe it isn't at all.
Man, I forgot about that. I remember reading about the NAACP thing and mm-hmm. and you know, by that time in my life, I had developed a much more complex and layered understanding of the role the NAACP has played in disciplining black liberation movements, as well as other so-called anti-racist type movements. To the extent that it's so premised on a politics of respectability, which is, I think it's a phrase, I'm actually thankful that people use that phrase now, because I don't think that the notion of respectability actually being a political position has as much traction as it's had over the last, I don't know, decade, maybe dozen years or so. So the NAACP being one of, I think, you know, and I think probably by its own definition, by its own platform, by its own mission statement, one of probably the primary organizations in like in modern hemispheric or North American history that has adjoined a politics of respectability to a kind of liberal progressive politics of anti-racism and of Black civil rights, right? And of militant Black civil rights. And you know, to their credit, you know, in their own ways, supporting movements against U.S. apartheid. Here's a moment in which the NAACP tells on itself again, right? It reveals the limitations of its politics, because what it's there for is to try to assert a representation of something which is an absurdity on top of an absurdity, which is the respectable Black cop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and they're doing this in the context of a film in which the Black cop is actually being modeled after an Afro-Latinx cop, Rafael Perez, who is, you know, among the most deeply publicly implicated police officers in really in the history of the United States in anti-Black violence.
Mm-hmm.
In anti-Black policing, right? In criminalization and harassment and intimidation of large-scale Black and Latinx communities throughout L.A. So the NAACP thing just, to me, adds layers of laughter.
There's a way in which Denzel's portrayal is the most accurate to a cop in the movie, you know, maybe with not as much bombast, maybe with not as much Riz, but like he is, you know, and that's my immediate, you know, kind of surface level reaction to the NAACP thing is like, oh, it all has to just be like what all Black portrayals of Black people have to be positive. Like how it reminds me of like, one of the jobs that I've had is like running commercial casting sessions. And, you know, sometimes the ad guys will be in the room and they'll want to ask actors like, you know, tell us your name, your height, blah, 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 and give us a little thing about yourself. And one person talked about like almost getting it was relevant to the spot, but almost getting hit by a car on their bike, but they survived and they blah, blah, blah. And the person left and they were like, that was kind of intense, right? I was like, everyone in Chicago has a story about almost getting hit by someone if they're a biker. And the idea that these advertising guys cannot handle, you know, everything in commercials has to be so
hygienic.
hygienic. Everything's got bumpers on it. It's soft. Mm-hmm. Everyone's multi-ethnic and blah, blah, blah. And like, that seems to be what the NAACP wants for all portrayals of Black people. But then to realize that on an even deeper level, what they are advocating for is a positive portrayal of a cop.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that gets really insidious.
It's so contradictory, but also interesting to see how quickly it was recuperated in 2001, right? So Washington's case was, well, all of these great white actors, Gene Hackman, et cetera, they've played crooked cops. So I get to play a crooked cop. So he pushed back against it with this kind of like equal opportunities logic, right? And then winning the Oscar then becomes this, like, I think this moment of like pretty clear recuperation of, you know, he himself being this like model figure who's able to, you know, he's a good man, he's a Christian man, he's a family man, and he's somehow able to inhabit this horrible, evil figure, right? He won the Oscar on the same night that Sidney Poitier won the Lifetime Achievement Award too. And there's like such an interest. I mean, I watched his Oscar speech, which was like a third about Sidney Poitier, and to think about like In the Heat of the Night or these kinds of things, living in the shadow of this other figure, and in the way in which he had to play this. I mean, I don't know if you've seen In the Heat of the Night recently or thought much about that film, but like, wow, what a complicated, like, respectability politics meets ACAB meets, like, I don't know. It's such a muddy, muddy film. And Sidney Poitier's just legacy is haunted by these questions. So, I don't know. It does seem like a blip where there was concern over this. And now we're supposed to, like, really deeply celebrate this as an achievement in Washington's career, of being able to tap into this horrible monster or something like that, right? There's some kind of other exceptionalism in that narrative.
And then I think what accentuates your point, Madeline, is that in the kind of soundbite cultural memory around this performance, around this particular Denzel Washington performance, being his Academy Award winning, you know, main act, you know, whatever, best actor performance, he's remembered as a caricature of a caricature.
Yes.
In terms of the soundbite memory of it, right? The soundbite memory of it is the whole King Kong speech.
Right. Get. Yeah.
Yep.
Right. It's not the other parts of this performance that you could point at and say, like, this is Denzel approaching something like his best. Right. I don't think he's ever his best in this film, but there's moments where he approaches something like his best, in my humble, whatever, untrained opinion. But that's what he's known for, which says something else about what the cultural imaginary is doing and what it wants to, the way in which it wants to remember and project Black characters, and particularly maybe Black cops, right? And Black anti-heroes, I think, in the broader sense of so-called Black anti-heroes, which I think are, in many cases, much more capable of subversive possibilities than so-called Black heroes. Which is, of course, that's what the NAACP is looking for, by and large, right? They don't want Black anti-heroes. They want Black heroes, which I think, you know, it's just a bad cultural politics. But there's something about that way in which the kind of the vulgar sense of a national cultural memory, which is always deeply anti-Black, it remembers the King Kong speech. So there's something about the anti-Blackness.
Let's talk about the King Kong speech, I think... In my opinion, that is maybe the clearest the movie is and the closest it comes to a clear-eyed representation of this type of guy. And the way it's misremembered is really important too, because I misremembered it. We were getting to the last like 15 minutes of the movie. I'm like, did I miss the fucking King Kong speech? I remembered it happening during the day. It really happens at night. I remembered it being this like, as like I superimposed the King Kong speech over the movie poster, which is like him kind of striding in a leather jacket. Instead, he's like, if he's not on the ground, he either just got off the ground or is about to go back to the ground. And speaking of Corleones, I watched the Godfather movies recently. This reminded me of Fredo. He's having a Fredo moment.
Yeah.
It is so, he is begging. The King Kong Ain't Got Shit on Me is the most pathetic. He is pleading for, like, please give me my money so that I can save my life from these Russians. And I think that's like a really, to see that for what it is, gets close to a radical portrayal of a cop like this. But then, of course, in the popular imagination, it becomes this braggadocious,
peacock,
you know, yeah, exactly. Gets mixed with the general like swag of the character.
Yeah, it's actually pathetic. It's like totally. It's last words.
It's very intentionally pathetic. Basically. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's not super satirical in that moment, I think.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree.
I found out some things about the casting. There was a point at which it was going to be Matt Damon and Samuel L. Jackson. And I was kind of, that kind of helped me understand the controversy of, like, it's not that Washington replaced Samuel L. Jackson, but Samuel L. Jackson would fit much more kind of neat and tidily into this character, right?
Cartoonally, yeah, for sure.
Cartoonally. That there's like a comfort in, or maybe it's not a comfort, but there is something uneasy about Washington taking on this on this role that I was trying to remember about this, that he had, I think he put a list of some of his movie, like the movies right before, but like, yeah, Remember the Titans.
Yep.
Like inspirational teacher movie is right before this movie. Yeah. Right. Malcolm X.
Yeah.
We have Philadelphia. The Pelican Brief always comes to mind, where like in this film of you're supposed to distrust literally everyone, but there's something about Denzel Washington's eyes and face and the way that he talks to Julia Roberts, and you just know that he is the only safe person in that movie, right? Mm-hmm. But he, and then of course Glory is the first movie that he won an Oscar for, right? So there was, I mean, it was a huge departure, but I was just trying
to don't forget Hurricane.
Did Hurricane come out before?
Hurricane,
after
I was remembering.
Yeah, it was
before.
I've never seen Hurricane.
Yeah, I remember seeing, I saw her. There was something, I had to look it up just now as you were talking, because I was like, there's something else in there where he was on the other side of shit from.
But
you know,
he's a martyr in that.
Yes. Right? He's like wrongfully convicted and he becomes, you know, so he plays Reuben Carter. And then before that, don't forget about when he was Jesus Shuttlesworth's dad.
Oh, right.
Ray Allen's dad, and he got game.
That's right.
Another
right.
one, right? He's on the other side
that's
of this.
Right,
like,
before
he's,
too.
Yeah, he's incarcerated, and he's come. So he's, and Malcolm X was incarcerated. So it's, what's interesting is that his kind of acting trajectory through the 90s is that he plays these kind of anywhere from like flawed but deeply vulnerable and human, you know, characters to like heroic characters of people who were incarcerated for a period of time and represented a particular kind of Black male heroism and Black male fatherhood and Black male persistence. You know, I'm saying like cis male and hetero male, right? Persistence coming out of those positions in different ways, from Hurricane to He Got Game to Malcolm X. And then now like the script is actually being flipped in
well, this is the bottleneck through which he passes into fucking the guy who did three Equalizers, into Man on Fire, you know, into these like variations of a Jason Bourne or a Robin Hood sort of role, which honestly seem like they seem fun. Like Denzel Washington,
I can't
is
turn off Equalizer,
of,
by the way. Just
oh,
by the
yeah,
way.
Yeah.
I can't
I've never
Equalizer.
Seen them, but they're on my list.
I can't turn off John Wick. Like anything that involves like, you know, revenge, you know, individual revenge thing. It's like there's some kind of fantasy world there. I'm having trouble letting go of it.
I think where I relate to you deeply, Dylan, is I think there's a thread of anger that we have both
attempted to channel. It's not a thread.
Oh, it's the river. It's the main river.
Like,
itself.
As I described to somebody just the other day, and I've described to others before, some of us are just wired in a certain way where there's an endless reservoir. And we just need to learn how to be with it.
Sure. Totally. Totally.
Those who know me and love me will only affirm what I just said. So there's something about that. There's definitely something about that. Yes, I'm with you on that.
But I think that, I think the way in which, so I think Madeline, the thing you're saying about Denzel's public persona reflected through the art is the thing that keeps him from seeming like a villain unequivocally from the start.
Yeah.
Because we know Denzel is playing this. We know so there is a metatextual thing going on from the very beginning. And then the thing that makes it that keeps it from being just cliche for me, or the way in which like all the cliches like get set up like so much scenery, so that really what I'm seeing in this movie is like an acting face-off. Two guys like honestly like having fun, you know, and like and that scene,
or maybe
early,
just one of them having fun,
maybe Hawk, but I think I think Ethan Hawke is having a different kind of fun, you know, like and that early scene in the diner, the tell me a story scene where Denzel is like trying to read his newspaper, and then he's like making Ethan Hawke telling him this boring story about DUI, and he's being like fucking misogynist and horrible, and then he just like randomly is just like boom, like jukes Ethan Hawke. I'm like, this is funny. This is like this scene, I could watch this kind of shit like all day. It's just so, and you know, there's such a big thing made out of like actors improvising on set. But one thing that Denzel has said is that there was a lot of improvisation, and it sounds like there was an attempt to like keep each other off balance. And that sense of like joy in their craft is the thing that I do find very entertaining.
I think you
about
can feel
movie.
It.
Yeah.
And I like that. I don't know. Go ahead, Dylan.
I mean, no, the thing I enjoyed about one particular moment that we haven't touched on yet, if we're going to talk about, you know, audience joy, I enjoyed the fuck you white boy moment where Alon just leaves him to get fucking offed by Smiley and them.
Yeah.
You know, I think the first time I watched, I'm like, oh, I'm going to watch this motherfucker get his brains blown out in the bathtub. And then I was like, oh, fuck it. It's going to be some bullshit where he rescued the niece, I think, or the cousin.
Yeah.
The cousin. Yeah.
Oh, I was like, okay. But you know what, Alonzo, I enjoyed the gesture. Because you kept it real. Alonzo, you kept it real. Like you showed us what LAPD really is.
Right.
Because anybody who knows what they know would say like in outside the narrative of Training Day, some version of that shit would have meant coffins, would have meant 6 feet under the dirt for good old Jake.
I was wondering in that moment. I knew of course he's gonna survive, but I was like, this would be such a better movie if he just died right here. It would be memorable, and actually probably Ethan Hawke's performance would be more celebrated or something like this, right?
Well, my favorite Ethan Hawke moment in this movie is like, it's a much tamer version of the King Kong speech. It's mm-hmm. Ethan Hawke being pathetic, and it's, to me, I thought it was so funny. Like when they are first at Rogers, the ex-cop drug dealer's house, and mm-hmm. and
Scott Glenn.
Scott Lind, is that his name?
Scott Glenn.
Glenn, yes, yeah. I know. I'm familiar by face more than name. But like,
sure.
So Scott Glenn, Denzel, and Ethan Hawke are there. And Denzel and Scott Glenn are like having a good time with each other. And Ethan Hawke's like uneasy. He's trying to figure out like what's going on. He's trying to maybe impress these guys. And they're all like rattling off these sort of aphorisms and sort of street knowledge. And then Ethan Hawke has this thing where he's like, you want to know my theory about this work, about the street? And they're like, sure, what's your theory? And he's like, it's all about smiles and cries. You got to control your smiles and cries. This never comes back later in the movie. It's just Ethan Hawke being a fucking dork, being like, here's my grand theory. And they just look at him and they're like, what the fuck are you like? It's like his attempt to be like wise and funny, and it just falls totally flat. And that as comedy worked completely for me.
Yeah. So the guy who wrote this, David Ayer, did you look into this?
No.
He's a white guy, grew up.
I just know a little bit. Yeah, I just know that he's some kid that grew up in LA and thinks he can write scripts about fucking black people.
How much he, quote, grew up in the projects is highly debatable. But he also wrote another script that came out that year, Fast and Furious.
Yo! Amazing! We've covered Fast and Furious on the podcast before, Dylan. I don't know what your relationship is to that, though.
I saw the first couple, and then I was like, okay, once we get to 3 and then 3 through 10 or whatever, X, whatever we're in right now.
Yeah, we covered 8, so we were pretty deep when we
I just
when we
skipped to 8
eight.
When we... No, but that to me said something not necessarily about the genre of... I don't know. I just thought that was an interesting kind of connection. Okay, the same mind who came up with Training Day is the guy who came up with those fucking movies.
Well, that should tell us something, right?
It does.
I bet you there's probably like a Reddit somewhere that thinks about Training Day and Fast and Furious 1 or something as being in the same together. Cinematic universe.
Right.
Yeah, quite
well,
possibly.
It certainly points to it being a popcorn movie.
It's
thinking of itself in those terms for sure.
Which I think, if I remember correctly about the Oscars, was in addition to Denzel's like complicated portrayal. I think, tell me if I'm wrong, but my memory is of like, wait, Training Day was nominated for an Oscar? Wasn't that kind of like a popcorn? Wasn't that kind of just like a silly action
All of
movie?
The awards were just for acting, mostly for Washington.
Yeah.
Right. And then there was kind of, again, I think the boxing analogy works, especially because the other big actor up for the Oscar was Will Smith for Ali. And so there was kind of that was how that award was being talked about and the politics of it and all of these things. So,
man, I totally
weirdly full circle. Then they went up against each other in 2022, right? And Denzel Washington was like giving Will Smith like fatherly advice about, you know, having just assaulted Chris Rock how to go and give his best actor speech after that.
Well, this is where it gets, I mean, to me, the slap and all of that is where it becomes less about race and more about class, but even more like celebrity culture. And even the thing you were hinting at with Denzel being like, they've gotten to play bad cops. Now it's my turn. Mm-hmm. I think that speaks to the limited imagination of especially mainstream movies of like, this is the fun role you get to play. Is this like politically regressive, completely state and whatever reinforcing stereotype. And I think that is part of the problem is that like the things we're entertained by that they decide we get entertainment by is like bad cops and slaps at the Oscars.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's a very 70s kind of anti-hero thing too, right? The bad cop, these like incredibly, selfish acting parts, right? Like Al Pacino, right? Just these, that kind of role. And it's hard not to hear the athletic analogy or something like that. There is like a hyper-competitive drive to these roles and being able to get one of these roles that I think was just like the meta kind of layer of all of that Oscar buzz and things like that around Washington. And he was like, he was gaming that, right? I think that that's kind of, I don't know. I think that's mostly what this movie is really about. Like, there's not really a there in the movie itself for me. It's more just like, what was this cultural moment that this thing came out of? Because it's kind of just a boring movie, right?
Yeah.
Well, it's also subscribed to it, right?
It's also an LA. It's also a certain kind of LA moment. Just to add what you're saying, Madeline, because I was thinking about it and. I believe this movie's right in between, by way of police movie, LA police movies, for example, right? It's right in between Heat and Crash.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah, I think Crash came out a few years later, right? So this is so there's something within that particular late 90s, early 2000s LA police thing where I think that there's a narrative drive to Maybe to try to narratively relegitimate the LAPD, as well as maybe periodically vindicate it, right? So it's like I don't think it was quite at the level of vindication, but there's a narrative move that is constant and persistent. I believe LAPD were consultants on this film. I'm pretty sure. Oh, I know there's a lot of shit around like you had OGs from different Blood and Crip sects that were also part of the extras involved. And consulting all this shit. Yeah. And they were like in the neighbors. And all. So there's all that weird kind of extractive relationship that Hollywood has to these neighborhoods and these folks, these criminalized folks. But there's something about the narrativity surrounding LAPD in the aftermath of the LAPD uprising. People call it the Rodney King uprising, the LAPD uprising in 92. And then the Rampart scandal, not long after less than 6 years later, and then this kind of movement between films like Heat, films like Crash, and then in between a film like Training Day, which is, the more I'm thinking about it, the more I'm talking about it with y'all, it's like an aggressive satire of LAPD police violence. And of course it's important. And I say this in a really direct, plain way. Like, I think it's actually really narratively important that the primary villain, antagonist, whatever you want to call it, like the primary state actor in this film, the one who carries out all of the wretchedness, who carries out the intimidation, the misery, who positions himself as a constant threat to Black people among whom he lives, right, is a Black cop. Mm-hmm. So I think that there's something narratively important about that, in which, again, what you have is a certain kind of cultural apparatus that is adjacent to the state, adjacent to the police. It's not a direct outgrowth of it, but it's near it, right? That believes it is now important to tell the story of the anti-Black cop, right? Mm-hmm. So I'm going to say that there's something about that. Again, it's being done in this kind of bizarrely satirical, folks want to call it dark, whatever, right? So there's some particular way in which it's going down, but I think there's something there pedagogically, by which I mean something to be read, something to be analyzed with and alongside other people, that I think is really important, you know, that you have the primary anti-Black villain being a Black cop.
I think that's really a great point, thinking about it in that chronology. The other film that comes to mind in that chronology is Falling Down, which came out in 93, like really, I think, was being made during the uprising. The difference being that you have these scenes where you're like actually embedded in the LAPD office. You're like kind of seeing the infrastructure. The fact that all of that is totally closed off from Training Day is really unique and interesting. The only part where I can recall the like bigger apparatus of the LAPD really coming in is in the end, when we're hearing, you know, the news story and how it's been sort of how it's been rewritten, right? How
the press conference,
right? Yeah. I think that's the only point where we get anything from the LAPD, though, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think
that they're giving the last word.
Well, also by setting it in Alonzo's office, his car, the LAPD gets deniability, where it's like, this man is so not a part of us that you literally never see him in a police building. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So they get to keep him as far away at arm's length as possible.
Well, I mean, that's that's the narrative and visual, you know, I'm gonna call it the sleight of hand, but I mean that sleight of hand in like a fourth grade magician way, right? So it's not slick. So I mean, it's not slick, right? But the fact that you just brought it up, Alonzo's office, Alonzo's car, right? Can you, like, it's hard to find a car that is more not like a police car,
right?
Or
right.
More not like an undercover police car, for that matter.
Sure, sure.
Than Alonzo's muscle car. Right, that shit is like calling for attention. It is like announcing to everybody that I am the badass cop who's, you know what I mean? I'm the badass cop who lives outside the law, who carries impunity with my badge, will fuck your girlfriend and like steal your drugs and use them and sell them and fuck with this white boy and dump him off in the Chicano part of town to get his face blown off. That is me and that is what I do. I mean, so there's something about that is adjacent to that narrative of the anti-Black cop that further situates Alonzo's character as outside the realm of real policing, narratively, right? Like his car does that trick. That's that clumsy sleight of hand I'm talking about. I was like, he's a cop, but he's not really one of them, you know? And so then the work of the LAPD, as you said, Madeline, is by the end of the film, you realize that the primary work of the LAPD is to kind of launder Alonzo's aftermath, you know, to literally public relations their way out of it, right? But again, that's another way that Hollywood and LAPD's consultations with Hollywood, largely unintentionally, it again kind of tells on itself, because what you also walk away from this film feeling or understanding, if you're talking to the right people is that, okay, on the one hand, police power itself is violently absurd. It's violently, mm-hmm. it's like violently satirizing itself all the time, right? And then secondly, that police power is a narrative power.
Right.
You know, that narrative is not yeah. secondary or corollary to police power, but that is central to it.
Absolutely. You know, police,
and they're doing it throughout the fucking film.
And it gets to determine who is a hero. Like, the fact that the last word is positioning Alonzo as a hero, right? It's like
yeah.
so decisive in that way.
And then even you rewind just a little bit, and like when they corner Jake and they're like, all right, here's the story we're going to tell.
Mm-hmm. Right.
After they off their guy, after they blew that dude away in his easy chair, right? They're like, okay, so Jake, are you on board or not? Because here's the story. Boom, boom. Here's the, and it's a narrative. It's like it's a step-by-step narrative. Jake, are you on board? Because this is what police power looks like. This is what police power looks like. Jake, you on board? And he resists. And they're like, well, you know what? Here's the other thing that can happen is that we can get rid of you. And this is the other story that's going to happen. So police power can be one of these two stories you pick.
Hmm.
And so, you know, again, pedagogically, narratively, there's something very important and pedagogically useful there for us to take mm-hmm. with us. So maybe I should be saying thank you, Hollywood, huh?
Yeah. Well, yeah,
I do.
Go.
I do think those are strong elements. I was wondering, did you see We Own This City? The it's about the Baltimore police scandal.
It's a scandal
in the same sense. No, it was a mini series that David Simon did. Maybe 2022.
Talk David about complicated Simon relationships with police.
It's over the It's over the killing of Freddie Gray.
It is not
okay.
But it is about a. It's about that police gang in Baltimore that got corruption charges in. I'm looking at now 2018 and 2019.
Oh yeah.
And John Bernthal plays like his Alonzo. It's like he's basically doing an impression of Alonzo, which I'm realizing in hindsight. But I was just wondering if you'd seen that. But that's, I think, more effective in that kind of David Simon-y way where it's like networked power, right? Like looking at all of the ways that that various institutions are like upholding these and re-narrating and making possible these kinds of corruptions at the ground level. So, but I think that's a very interesting feature of Training Day that you're bringing up that I really hadn't thought very much about, which is about this like insistence on its containment, right? It's contained within small spaces, contained within a day, contained within these two characters. It really doesn't know what it's doing with all these big questions and at least maybe has that insight, and so it's staying very close up, right?
Yeah.
But I wonder to what extent that is actually foreclosing some kind of whatever broader critique of the system or these type of things, right?
Totally.
It's insisting on it as a character analysis.
That's the argument against the NAACP. The mainstream argument is like, this is a very specific story about a very specific character.
Right.
Yeah. So it all gets to be exceptional in that way.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, you're making me think of, you know, the classic book that Stuart Hall and a bunch of his colleagues wrote back. I think it's been more than 40 years now, that famous book, Policing the Crisis, where mm-hmm. they think about the whole concept of a moral panic by way of, the narrative around mugging in the UK, and they spend like, you know, more than a dozen chapters, you know, several hundred pages thinking through this confluence of media apparatus, state and police apparatus, particularly the public relations apparatus. They think about how information and newsworthiness get determined through political interactions with state actors, especially elected officials, mayors, you know, equivalents of and analogs of that. So, I mean, the genius of their book is they point out the role of the media in kind of complementing police power. And in addition to that, I think when we think deeply about the Hollywood apparatus that's adjoined to this, right? Because they're talking about the news media. They're not talking about popular mm-hmm. cultural media nearly as much as they are the news media, right? Like mm-hmm. what counts as respectable and acceptable, credible news. if we think about that alongside these kind of fictionalized, high budget, award-winning cinematic portrayals, then it just helps us understand how broad the regime of police narrativity actually is. Hollywood and the police are fully involved in this kind of engine, this narrative engine of policing all the time. Which is why the main, I think the main and most effective cinematic narratives you get around police power are primarily documentary, mm-hmm. right? In terms of stuff that's like, that gets a decent circulation. I mean, there's a ton of independent stuff that folks have put out in various independent media venues, which I think is the future anyways, right? I think this Hollywood shit's going to collapse any minute. Like it's basically gone, right? Like if we look at the shit that Hollywood's producing, it, like there's Hollywood now and then Hollywood 20 years ago. They're not the same Hollywood. Yeah. So there's that. There's that just material.
I mean, I did just get my SAG card, Dylan. So
yeah, maybe good luck.
You could hold off for just a couple more years.
Man, you came late to the game. That's all right.
It's true. Right. I know.
You might have to burn that card any second.
You know? I'm behind on my dues anyway. So there
you know what I mean? So yeah, but there's something about the role that Hollywood in particular plays within this apparatus of police knowing. Right, the kind of the episteme of policing, you know, in other words, the way in which we both come to know, and I say we in the broadest, most robust sense of we, as problematic as that is, that there's a way in which we come to know police, the way in which we come to know policing and police power, that arguably is primarily in these days happening through Hollywood, right?
Well, I think it's interesting that maybe the most powerful weapon the cops have is narrative. That's something that's a really fascinating like way of thinking about it that I hadn't put in those terms. I mean, the thing it's making me think of is in Chicago right now, we just got a sort of qualified win with a campaign to stop this technology called ShotSpotter. Which is a like surveillance technology, like supposedly like records the yep. sound of a gunshot and gets police on the scene as quick as possible.
Has bullshit led technology, to, everybody. Yeah. Sorry to interject. Bullshit
yeah, no,
technology it's doesn't horrible. Actually work.
Oh, not fucking, not even close. But
I mean, your car door hard enough means it's going to send the cops. It's like it's a pretext. It's a pretext right. for the police to go to where the fuck they want to go. Okay, anyway, sorry.
Dave, no, continue. Dude, that's it exactly.
For controlling the narrative. Is
absolutely,
point,
exactly,
right?
Absolutely. And that yeah. that the cops argument is like this is a. I mean, it's the law and order thing. It's like it's such a bullshit thing that never worked. In fact, led to deaths in Chicago mm-hmm. because. If you're a cop who just got a ShotSpotter call, you're fucking charged up.
Yeah.
You're ready to go into a war zone, you know? And like and these there were these big public meetings where the narrative was that the people in the Stop ShotSpotter campaign yeah. were all white people who weren't actually in the community, who didn't actually know, just not true at all. I mean, they're like straight up like looking at black people and thinking, making the mistake of thinking that they're white people and spreading mm-hmm. that on Twitter. So they it's so much about like, oh, well, this company, we need something specific. The idea of like, well, we have the specifics, invest in after school programs, invest in, give people cash, they will buy food and homes. You know what I mean? Like that is specific, but people want something, this skeleton key, this magic bullet that's like, I mean, literally, that's like, oh, this is a new technology. It will save us, even though it doesn't work at all. And it's all because this company is able to work with the cops to go, hey, we found the magic solution.
Yeah, this is actually, I think, directly tied to the way we're thinking about training day is what I think so many folks who intend to be grounded analysts, critical analysts of police power, right? They want to be grounded and want to intervene on it. They want to maybe disrupt it. They might even want to abolish it. Okay. Like they might say they want to abolish it, which, you know, I'm just saying bring some skepticism into that, right? Because like you really want to think deeply if somebody really wants to abolish that. But the thing that so many of, I'm gonna call them our folks, right? Like that community of people, the thing that so many within this larger community of people, which I count myself a part, is that we fairly consistently underestimate the promiscuity of police power as a logic that exceeds the police itself. Mm-hmm. Which is to say that whatever the technology might be, whether it's something called
We don't need to get it right.
Okay, yeah. The thing we're talking about, or Hollywood film, right? As technologies, right? Yeah. As technologies. Mm-hmm. These things do not avoid that promiscuous flow of police power as a logic that goes beyond the police. Right? For that matter, the place I work, University of, there are, like I've been saying and writing stuff about, you know, saying the university is a cop, right? Mm-hmm. Like the university apparatus, especially public universities, right? They, not only are they not insulated from it, they are fully involved in assimilating, refining, and then rearticulating the logics of police power in their infrastructures, in their institutions, in their routines, in their pedagogies, in their curricula, right? As well as, of course, in the way in which they discipline each other, including students, including staff, including faculty, right? Hollywood is no different. The spot shot or technology is no different, right? Like data, the notion of data collection, Ruha Benjamin and others have written about this, like really, you know, Simone Brown, other folks have written about this really well, which is, you know, the so-called carcerality of data. It's like, that's the whole point. Data cannot not be policing. It cannot not be carceral when you are in a policed, carceral, anti-Black world, right? When you're in a colonial world, that shit cannot not be colonial. Of course, there's ways you can turn it anti-colonial. You can turn it, you know, toward abolitionist, Black liberationist possibilities. But in terms of the kind of the normative flow of this shit, like it's, we shouldn't be surprised by it. Mm-hmm. No? So that's why I think we're misled to think that some kind of technology will liberate us. This was where I developed all kind of contusions on my skull, banging my head against the desk throughout 2015 through now, maybe a little bit less now, being part of and around campaigns, which are essentially campaigns to respond to police violence, especially including fatal police violence, by way of relying on police technology, including body cams. Right. The fact that we had to have such an extended debate within multiple political communities around the efficacy or the potential efficacy of police body cams, meaning really police technology, to slow or to eliminate fatal killings of Black people, you know, unhoused people, etc. It made me really sad and really angry. The fact that we had to have that conversation, primarily because we don't have an adequate analysis. So maybe Training Day, maybe fucking this reading of Training Day can help get us there, where we just understand, like, you cannot trust the technology. It is not to be trusted. You know, well, it is not to be, yeah.
No, the thing we covered, it makes me think of the, like, journalist story. We talked about the Netflix series Inventing Anna, a couple of episodes back.
I can pay, Dave. I can pay.
Yeah,
I can pay.
We should. That would have been amazing to have Dylan on the Inventing Anna, the wire transfer. But so it's a weird connection to make. But the thing that I kind of realized in rewatching that was that, like, this idea of the journalist by needing a story to make a living already does not have objectivity. There's no, like, they have a stake in the story. And in a way, when it comes to cop stories, Hollywood is the sort of journalist, or like the filmmakers or the producers are that journalist where they're like, we're making a movie about cops. It needs to make money. Which is why it happens on the mainstream, and you can get away with other things where people know they're not going to make money, so it's just a passion project. But if you need to make money, you have to align with certain perspectives and narratives about cops and continue to tell cop stories.
Yeah, I mean, I'm interested in this in terms of the history of detective fiction specifically. Like, there's this great book by Ernest Mandel, who's not known for writing about detective fiction, obviously, but I'm trying to remember what it's called. A Scandalous Murder. I'll look it up. But a lot of what he's writing about is like how the detective figure is imbued with this desire for sense making, right? Like we live in a world of indeterminacy and like all sorts of systemic crises. And so this one figure comes in.
Delightful Murder, a social history of the crime story.
Yeah. Thank you very much. It's a great book. The power of this figure to come in and like, you know, as if magically, right? Like Sherlock is like a magical figure, which I think the recent BBC show actually kind of like really gets, is that he is kind of a magician and that he can see in this almost supernatural way. But there's a desire for that kind of figure to come in and construct order through narrative, right? To present a narrative logic, and for that to just like settle what cannot be settled, right? About this world, right? At a more systemic level, like to take a murder as an instance of this that can be resolved on behalf of, you know, a chaotic world or something like that, right? And so there's something very interesting about these archetypes that police narratives often have. However, I'm just going to say this, Training Day doesn't have that figure, right? I do think that's kind of an interesting thing, which I'm realizing in the course of this conversation, all of these kinds of tropes that are very easy to bring in, right? Oh, Alonzo's got some boss who's even more crooked, or there's at least some scenes in the LAPD where they're piecing something together, or even just Jake being assigned to this guy as his mentor. None of those things happen, right? There isn't like a reporter figure trying to figure it out in the end, right? It's very sparse and economical in terms of like these, sense making figures that are often brought in, to give us some false sense of resolution, right, at the end. So I don't know. It's kind of like, it's an interesting movie in the ways that it's unwilling to do those moves, and it's kind of like whether or not intentionally just very problematic, right? The scene that really stuck with me that I really wanted to talk about with you all is that scene in the end in the neighborhood where he's surrounded. I know we talked about his speech and the King Kong speech, but like really the more interesting part of that scene is the community's decision around like what they're going to do with this guy. And to me, if I'm going to be looking for like whatever utopian kernel of this film, and I'm going to insist that it probably is politically unintentional, right? It is that moment where the neighborhood is like, we're not going to be policed, right? This is a kind of agreement that we have with you to be policed, and we're not going to do it. Like we can overpower you and you're gone. The fucked up thing about that scene, though, is what happens with Jake, which is that they're just like, we've got your back.
Right.
Go off. You've got all this money.
You know, right? You know what that was, Madeline? Like that moment. Okay, so yeah, it's fucked up. But the reason why it made sense is, and this is a kind of counter reading within the counter reading, that was an agreement. That was an agreement among people who, that was an agreement between a cop and a shadow police. By which I'm talking about the shadow governing order of the project is going to be the gang. That's the whole, I mean, when gangs first came up, they weren't supposed to replicate racial capitalism. They weren't supposed to replicate the police, right? It's supposed to be a kind of form of self-determination that was liberatory, that like accelerated people toward various forms of strategic, political, and maybe even paramilitary confrontation with an apartheid state, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, right? Mm-hmm. But in that moment, what you had was, okay, so they're happy to get rid of this chaotic, toxic presence in the kind of singular figure of Alonzo, who's a badge-carrying LAPD cop who fucks with their police power, their shadow police power, right?
Yeah.
So this is an opportunity to get rid of him, and they have Jake's back because Jake knows his place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jake has the good cop. He knows his, he knows not to fuck with them, right? He knows that, like, that's the analog of police power that we have a kind of a tense cooperating relationship with. And also that's, you know, by mm-hmm. the way, that's also what made the so-called Rampart scandal so fucked up.
Okay.
Is that it fucked that kind of operating agreement, that cooperating kind of working agreement. Again, very tense, full of violence, full of contradiction, and full of all kinds of power and domination and criminalization, all kinds of shit, right? So I'm not saying in any way it's like this symmetrical playing field. Mm-hmm. But there's something happening there with, and this is the narrative point that I would say is unfolding, is it's normal. It's about normalization. You know, I mean, and I'm saying this in this moment where that term is so resonant for so many of us, because we're thinking about how Israel's genocidal actions are like, we're living in the real time moment in which an accelerated military extermination of an entire geography and entire population is actually being normalized, like in front of us in all these multi symbolic ways. And so it's within the a kind of similar tradition, I'd say, or like within a continuity of various fictional and narrative labors of normalization. Mm-hmm. And so that's why here in Training Day, it's like a bunch of fucking police chaos, right? There's no murder to be solved here, right? It's literally right. A training day. It's literally a day. Yeah. It's a day in the chaotic, you know, the chaotic kind of toxic life of policing. And so I think that's what, that's part of the kind of policing genius of this kind of narrative, is that it's so relentless. You know, the narrative force of normalizing police power, including chaotic, toxic, violent, black cop as the anti-black force, you know, mm-hmm. like these narratives are relentless and constant, and they're always spilling out. And they do this work of normalization that I think is, it's irrefutable that it happens, right? Now, I don't think it's foreclosed. I don't think it means that it works every time. I think, you know, here we are talking about it, you know, but I think it needs to be read against itself all the time.
Well, I think mm-hmm. also one of the reasons they let him go or have this like begrudging respect with Hoyt is there's an element of fairy tale there too, where he says
he becomes the wolf, right?
Oh no, I mean where he becomes like an angel almost, where he like looks at Denzel and is like, they're not like you. It's like the ultimate white saviorism moment, you know, where he's like, these are the people. And it's the flip side of another line that Denzel says, which is another line of this movie like really nailing some shit despite itself, which is when Denzel says, I'm the police, you just live here. And it's like, that's good, you know? Yeah. And but then Ethan Hawke being like, oh, they're, you know, these noble community members, like, these are the people I want to keep the drugs off the streets for, you know, is just
yeah.
like.
Yeah, and we see, like, there's the grandmothers and things. Like, it's not, like, a bunch of quote-unquote hoodlums on the street. This is, like, an actual community where there's children and elders, and they're all witnessing and coming out from their porch and kind of, you know, being together in that moment.
It's this, like, false attempt to be like, oh, look, it is about community. You know what I mean? It's like. As a way of validating police power,
and here's the part of the narrative that's left unsaid. But I mean, shit, if it was up to the NAACP, right? Then LAPD's next recruit would come from that crowd.
Mm-hmm.
They would replace Alonzo. They'd replace Alonzo with somebody from that fucking crowd.
Training Day 2
Jake would be like, "I'm going to
exactly."
That's what it would be.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. Yeah.
Yeah. I was thinking, cause I had a question sort of before this and I know it's a silly question, and you've through this conversation, it's been kind of beaten out of me, but I'll say what it was in the first place, which was, you know, is there any chance, like, what happens to Hoyt after this movie? Is there any chance that he quits the police force? Is there any chance that something, like, you know, genuinely anti-cop happens?
Isn't the answer, like, after that day, Jake should go home realizing this is not for you.
Well, yeah. Absolutely. But I think through this
conversation...
He should
have realized that before, though. Absolutely. I mean, why did he walk through the project with a gun?
Within
right?
5 minutes, like, this dude knew, I'm in over my head. This is not... I need to go...
I should have been a firefighter. He says
like,
it.
Or, like, move, man. Should've go been a firefighter. To San Diego Valley. Like, go to, you know... Yeah. Move to Irvine. Big dog, like...
That was the part I was hating so much. That decision... I mean, it is visually... It's a compelling moment. It's obviously necessary plot-wise, but why does he make that decision to go to
because
a long
because he played strong
walk on
safety in high school, Madeline.
I know.
He can take a hit, exactly. And he can lay out hits too, okay?
It was just so nonsensical.
It's,
I mean,
it's the power of his conviction. He's so convicted. He has so much conviction in that moment that he trusts. He's able to look at Terry Crews and the other guy blocking the.
What a great cameo!
Yeah, I mean, right. Talk about a problematic figure, but like, and just trust that they'll under. I'm here for Alonzo, and they know that their real Robin Hood is finally there to save them, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was the real barf moment for me. But I think from that moment, we're supposed to, make some assumptions about what he's going to do the next morning, right?
Yeah.
Which is, pull up his sleeves and clean up.
Which of course,
you know,
he is. Because he was in the military. There's no way that he spent however long he did in the military and that this is going to be the thing that makes him become a firefighter.
What kind of a guy wants to be a narcotics detective and he hasn't smoked weed since college also? Like, right? There's just stuff about it.
Look,
that, Madeline, I don't know.
The character is bizarre. The earnest young white cop is a very powerful cinematic drug.
Yeah. Yeah, it's very true.
Shit never gets old.
You want to believe in it, but I don't know. I mean, I don't want to believe in it, but that's what's carrying that character forward is the desire.
I mean,
his possibility.
His like his nephew is probably that Jake Gyllenhaal character. What was called the cop movie, Last Watch or something like that.
Oh, I never saw it.
Oh, the one where he killed.
Yeah, how would we rate this
on
this
on his watch or something like that?
No, he and his partner get like blasted, but he survives and his partner doesn't.
There's another Jake Gyllenhaal one where he like killed a kid on duty. Yeah.
Wow. I wonder why he's choosing those roles all the time. Sorry.
I mean, yeah.
It's called End of Watch. My bad. End of Watch.
End of Watch.
Him and Michael Pena. Him and Michael Pena are in it. And,
oh, wow.
And Michael Pena. Sorry, spoiler alert, but it's obvious. Like, it's not even a spoiler, really.
It's not going to live.
They get blasted, and Michael Pena gets killed. And anyway, it's like I'm convinced that the Jake Gyllenhaal character is just like the younger nephew. He's like the nephew of Jake.
I have one more question about the cultural moment of this movie, which is that I found out it was set to release like the week of 9/11 or maybe the week after, and they bumped it back a month. And I'm familiar with that move being like in comedy, like, oh, how can we do Saturday Night Live when this has happened or something like that. Right. But what do you think the particular threat of this movie coming out close to 9/11 was, or how do you understand that moment?
I have a really cynical
that it emerged from.
I have a much more cynical. Yeah, I love it. My view on it is that I think that executives believe that the kind of ceremonies of national mourning and spectacle around the spectacle of and terror and all this shit of 9/11. I believe that they thought that would cut into both what do you call it, the box office. Mm-hmm. Because people were, you know, scared to go out and shit like that.
Scared to go out.
Yeah, like there was a real thing going on where people like didn't want to go to places because they, you know, thought that a movie theater or a mall is the next thing to get bombed or incinerated or something like that. I remember living in a neighborhood. Mm-hmm. I lived in this small little neighborhood right near UC Riverside campus. And I went to my mailbox one day and my middle-aged white neighbor was going to her mailbox and she literally had latex gloves on. Wow. And she saw me kind of looking at her and she goes, "Oh, you can never be too careful." I'm like, "I don't think that they're coming for you. They're not sending you anthrax in your mailbox." Like, I don't think they give a shit about you. But like, I'm saying that was the cultural moment was that. I don't think this was a move toward a kind of catering to some kind of national mourning sensibility. I think this was about box office. It was about trying to avoid backlash because it's obviously like a violent movie and all that kind of shit.
Yeah,
right?
it's violence.
Not,
yeah.
Yeah. And it's not like a patriotic movie, right? If this shit was like Top Gun, then they would have rolled it right out and they would have put outdoor movie screens up for people that were scared to go inside and they would, you know what I mean? And everybody would have been cheering on Maverick and Goose, you know?
But that's why it actually makes sense that it came out only a month later, because the thing we got after 9/11 was the valorization of every cop and firefighter, you know, all these like service people.
Well, it doesn't quite fit easily into that either. And so I can understand. I mean, I think in hindsight, I actually did a poll of Genre Reveal listeners. 69% said that this was absolutely copaganda. 6% said it wasn't. And then 25% said it was kinda. I was interested in the kinda. But I think at the time, I don't know. I mean, it did seem like a little bit of a risky move to have a movie that was even like superficially critical of the police, right? And whether we could, we in the kind of national bullshit patriotic discourse could see any nuance in this at all. I mean, I think it's straight up propaganda, but I wonder how that propaganda like hit at the time, right? Because I don't think you could have any kind of critical representation of the police.
Well, okay. The cultural moment was also it was highly concentrated on NYPD and NYF.
True.
So it was like everybody was wearing NYPD baseball caps, right? So there's a weird way, as I think back on it, that a corrupt Rampart scandal aftermath LAPD actually did work in the service of the valorization of the upstanding first responder, asbestos breathing, et cetera, NYPD, people dying in the collapse of the towers, all that kind of shit, right? It's kind of this West Coast, East Coast juxtaposition of the two, you know what I mean? So I think that it might've been something like that, at least in my memory of it, the way that the narrative of LAPD and Alonzo Harris, and for that matter, Rampart Scandal was still live at that point, right? Like that shit did nothing to undermine the credibility of the police in the aftermath of 9/11. If anything, it just added to the specific kind of heroism of the New York Police Department. And for Giuliani too, for that matter, America's mayor, as they called him.
Yeah, he's great. No,
that,
I love
that
him.
Really makes, I love that guy. No, but it does kind of, this movie is a little bit anachronistic in that sense, right? Like, it definitely would not have been made in the same way had it been made 6 months later, right? And you can kind of sense that about it, that it doesn't quite know its place in its own moment. I don't know.
I feel like we're getting into curious about that genre question here.
Do you all have your genres in mind?
Since I have one, I guess I'll go first.
My
genre for this is pretty close to what I came up with. I believe this movie is a good Apple mythos. This is creating, we all know the bad apple in mainstream film history. This is seen as a particularly, potent version of a bad apple story. Mm-hmm. But I think, the flip of that, the sort of satirical nature of what we've got here, is that it builds the myth that there is a good apple in the first place. So that's my
the genre. Common sense. The common sense notion of the bad apple, though, is a misreading of the truism.
Oh yeah, it absolutely right? is. Yes, totally.
So could you unpack that a little bit with the good apple?
Like, oh, what? good. Okay, so the bad apple spoils the whole bunch. But right. by believing,
but every people just remember the bad.
People
apple
forget that the whole bunch is spoiled.
The second part of the sentence.
So yes. instead, they, I don't know if I can do it. Can I extend the metaphor? I'm gonna try.
This is improv, man.
Yeah, this is
come on,
academic, scholarly improvisation.
No such thing. I know enough of them. They don't do it very well.
No, they don't.
they yeah, so it's the belief that, well, the barrel is spoiled from the beginning. The barrel, it's a spoiled barrel. It's this fantasy belief that the bunch started good in the first place.
Mm-hmm. All barrels are bastards.
Abab.
All barrels like are that. Bastards.
Okay. Exactly.
Nice.
So what about you, Madeline? Do you have a genre?
Yeah, I do. Mine is peacock paganda.
Nice.
That's good.
It doesn't quite come off the tongue, but
peacock paganda. Abab and peacock paganda.
Yeah. I don't think anything is. You cannot take your eyes off of Denzel Washington in this movie. That is incontestable, right? Like, mm-hmm. he's a magnetic force. We yeah. want to watch him, even if we hate it, you know, if we're cringing. You can't take your eyes off of him. And I think that is an interest. I mean, that's a takeaway that I knew I would have, but I was glad to actually spend time with this movie and think about that. So,
Dylan, you got one?
I think I would. My working name for the genre would be Hollywood as a flimsy ass deputy.
Nice. I like it. Flimsy ass deputy.
HFAD. Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah, is that what that is?
That's great. I love because there's a certain like type of phrase that feels like a genre you could have on a placard in a video store.
Oh, yeah.
And then there's ones that just completely flaunt that. And I appreciate that you're doing the latter here, Dylan. You're just
I'm from the Blockbuster era, Dave. Like, I could see myself in an alternate universe, you know, being an assistant manager of Blockbuster and convincing my manager to let me create like a shelf that says the Hollywood.
Yeah, you have your shelf.
The Hollywood is a flimsy ass deputy.
Do you have others genre. That go in that? Can you think of others that go in this, that well, genre?
Shit, man. Like, I mean, I would put some of the aforementioned we'd throw right in mm-hmm. there, right? Crash yeah. for sure.
Heat crash for sure.
You know?
And everybody knew that in the moment.
Yes.
Which is
that thing like, won best really picture, didn't it? Didn't Crash yeah. won best picture?
I mean, yeah, it won best picture and no one believed it when it happened. And it was like more scandalous than La La Land almost, right?
Yeah.
It's like no one thought it deserved that award, which very interesting moment.
I mean, all politically, shit like
in terms of the politics of the Oscars.
I mean, even the righteous, the righteous shit, like, you know, Mississippi Burning, like that goes right in there.
Yeah,
that goes. I mean, all this stuff goes right in there. Like Hollywood's the flimsy ass deputy, but it does nonetheless.
I would really like to. I mean, feel free not to take up this assignment, but I'd be really curious to hear what you think of "We Own This City," which I just did a little bit of checking. It's set like right exactly after Freddie Gray's murder.
Okay.
Right. So the protests are kind of happening in the background and are actually like fueling some of the plot.
Well, I grew up in the DC, Virginia, Northern Virginia area. And mm-hmm. I became a collaborator and friend of the late great Marshal Eddie Conway, who was a longtime political prisoner. Was incarcerated for his activity with the Black Panther Party chapter in Baltimore, and his mm-hmm. his surviving significant other Dominic Stevenson, who's still in doing work in Baltimore, but like their work around the Freddie Gray stuff was so deep. Mm-hmm. So I've paid attention to a lot of the kind of counter narratives that have come out from mm-hmm. folks there, but I have not seen We Own This City. So I will take up that assignment.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting in the David Simon way where it's like, it is propaganda, but it's trying not to be propaganda. It's like it has all of these like inner counter readings in your language, right?
It's a very deep belief in the possibility of good police or something. Is that what it is?
Well, no. It's trying to do a systemic critique of the police system, right? But it's still kind of housed in this genre, right, that we're talking about. It's like, how do you escape that, right? So I don't know. It's probably more troubled politically than Training Day, which is just kind of straight up silly.
Yeah.
Which I think we didn't say enough.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, but it's pretty fun. The watchability is off the charts.
It's a fun action movie. You know, it has chase. It gives what we, it's a popcorn film.
Yeah.
You know, flick, but.
Yes, a flick. Also, I should say we are, you know, we haven't mentioned our sponsor of this episode.
Oh yeah. Who's our sponsor?
You know, we've had Ghost Energy Drink. We've had the Cheetos flavored mac and cheese. And this time it's a little heavier sponsor, but, despite all we've said about them, we are sponsored by the LAPD this episode. Please go check them out. Love their work. Huge fan.
I say fuck the police. Fuck the absolutely. LAPD.
Fuck me Riverside Police Department. For suggesting Dylan watch.
Fuck the Riverside Sheriff's Department.
Yeah. Fuck you, Dave.
Yeah. Fuck you, Dave. God damn it.
That's bookending this episode.
This is great. Dylan, do you, I mean, it's always a blast to talk to you. Thank you so much for doing the show. Is there something
such a blast
you want people, you know, for people who are interested in more of your work?
Oh, yeah. What should they do? You know what I did recently? I'm like too lazy and I think it's weird to create a website about myself. So I have not, I will never probably do that. But I did do a link tree recently. With a bunch of my shit, just like my writing, some live stream stuff I've been on, some pop, and some of it is scholarly type writing and some of it is more kind of public and popular type writing. And then
amazing stuff. Well, like that. We'll link that in the show notes.
Yeah. Yeah. I'll send you an email with the link tree in it and you can just throw that up in there.
Rad. Well, thank you so much, Dylan.
Thank you.
Hey, thank you for inviting me. We should, I think, do this on a regular basis. This is great. I've subscribed to the podcast.
I love
and,
that.
And nice. I'm honored at being allowed to come up with the new name of a genre. So I'm going to put that on my resume, y'all.
Yes, yes.
Oh, invented the Hollywood is the flimby ass deputy genre.
Well, stay tuned for season 3, folks. We've got that. So we don't know when we will be coming to you, but sooner rather than later, we'll be doing season 3. So thank you all for listening.